one of the verses of the one of the songs that you led just a moment ago, Ken. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day. That's true, with one exception, that is the Son of God himself. Time doesn't bear him away. And we've come here to honor him tonight. And I take off my hat to you, and I love you for your love for him. And I hope and pray that tonight you'll be brought a bit closer to him by studying this hour of his life when he was brought before the Jewish people and the Roman people. If we were to dig up the remains of a court trial, say 2,000 years from now, and some trial that took place during this year in which we're living now, 1977, the burning question, I'm told, would be, what was the real case against the man? And as we look back into the trial of Jesus, that also is of interest to us tonight. What was the real case against the man? We are able to look at it more objectively than the people who were living in his day were able. And tonight, the lesson will be a bit different. Perhaps it won't even be preaching, but it will be a reconstructing of the events that led up to his death and then the reading of his death. Now, in the trial of Jesus, there were two critical stages. One, the stage before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish court. And then there was the stage before Pilate, which was the Roman court. And we want to go back and pick up the thread of events and see if we can reconstruct it from the information that we have in the Scriptures. And I invite your attention to follow me through these events and from station to station as we follow the Lord in this trial. It was late on the Thursday night when he was arrested. I believe the arrest of Jesus could not possibly have taken place earlier than 11:30. You see, the Passover supper, by law, was not to have been eaten before the sun went down. And at this time of the year, the sun probably didn't go down till 6:30 or 7 o'clock. And then the feast that was eaten was not just a snack. It was a full course ceremonial meal with ceremonial washings and the ceremonial eating of the bitter herbs, the eating of the Passover lamb, the drinking of the wine. Of course, then you have the washing of the disciples' feet that is recorded in John the 13th chapter. And you have the lengthy conversation that surrounds that washing of the feet in John chapters 13 and 14. How he explained to them what he was doing and then gave them encouragement about where he was going. Then in John 14 and verse 31, the latter part of it says, when he had said these things, they departed after having sung a hymn, and they went out. In chapters 15 and 16 and 17, the conversation that is contained in those chapters was spoken from the time that they left the upper room until they got to the Garden of Gethsemane. They probably arrived in the Garden of Gethsemane sometime around 10 o'clock at night. These are all conjectures, but we have to fit them in there by the best method that we have in order to get a picture of when these events took place. And when they went there, then Jesus left 8 of the disciples. Judas was gone. He left 8 there at a convenient location and then took Peter, James, and John with him. And they went on a bit further. And then he left Peter, James, and John and went, as one of the Gospels describes it, a stone throw further, and went into a place of seclusion where he began to pray. And he prayed this song that we sang, "Abba, Father, if indeed it may, let this cup of sorrow pass from me, I pray. But nevertheless," he said, "not my will, but thine be done." He came back to check on his disciples and found that they were asleep. We look at them with wonder and amazement, and yet I understand them, and I think probably you do too. Sleep is hard to fight off on a Sunday evening at 6 o'clock when everything is quiet. I think if I would shout, it might maybe make a difference with some of you, but I know what they were going through. You do too. And so they thought, well, we'll just rest our eyes. And lo and behold, before you knew it, Jesus was shaking them, saying, "Can't you stay awake just an hour with me?" And they were startled, and it says they didn't know what to say. You know, they were so shocked that they would go to sleep on him while he was in this hour of agony. And he went away again and began to pray the same prayer. Luke says he sweat as though it were drops of blood coming out of his face, falling on the ground. And he came back again and found them asleep. And then he went away again the third time and prayed the same prayer. And then came back again and found them still sleeping. And he said, "Well, go ahead and sleep and take your rest." But then he noticed the trail leading up to the Mount of Olives was being filled with torches and lanterns. Matthew and Mark says he said, "He who is betraying me is at hand." He hadn't gotten there yet, but Jesus could see right off of the mountain, right off of this hill, and he could see the trail of lights, the trail of the lanterns coming, and he could hear probably the men talking and shouting and hear the weapons rattling, and here came those men who were going to arrest him. Now, there were two routes that could have been taken from the Mount of Olives to Caiaphas' house. I'm going to ask that we visualize that the balcony is the Mount of Olives. This is the way really that it's laid out. This building is beautifully arranged for this. So we'll just imagine that those of you who are up on the balcony, you're on the Mount of Olives. Let's imagine that. This area here, especially, immediately out from under the balcony, would be the Brook Kidron. And then this area right down front, the first 8 or 10 rows, would be the temple area. To the south of this area, there was what was called the City of David, the old, old city of Jerusalem. And that will let that area over there be the City of David. This area here and that area would what would be called New Town or New City. Now, the two routes that would lead from the Mount of Olives to Caiaphas' house, about where this door is, one of the routes would take the main road from Bethany, which went from Bethany right over there near that exit sign, and would come down near this post and go up the valley and would come around the northern part of Newtown and would come down the Teropian Valley, which is right here in front of the building here, and then would go over here to Caiaphas' house. That's one route they could have taken. Another route would have left the valley or would have left the Mount of Olives and would have come right down the valley or right down the mountain and across the valley, Kidron, and would have come up really around the other end of the building over here, around near Siloam's pool. And there was a stairway leading from Siloam's pool up into the city. And it was almost directly then into the house or the palace of Caiaphas. Now, which one of these two routes would you have taken if you had arrested a man and were going to bring him to trial and we wanted to keep it secret? You wouldn't have taken the main road all the way around the city. You would have taken this stairway, having crossed the Brook Kidron, up the stairway, and quickly into the house or the palace of Caiaphas. Distance and secrecy demanded that they took that shorter route, and those who've studied it closely say that that's what they must have done. And they brought him before Caiaphas to be tried. This was early in the morning, probably now past midnight.
maybe getting on down toward 1 o'clock. John doesn't give any details about the trial before Caiaphas. But whenever the trial before Caiaphas, really, this trial isn't mentioned in John. Matthew mentions it, Mark mentions it. But they brought Jesus first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. And yet John describes Annas also as being high priest. So they may have had a dual priesthood at that time. I don't know. But nevertheless, these are some of the things that happened there. Before these men, it says that the whole council were brought together, and that the whole council sought false testimony against Jesus. I was surprised that these men, supposedly honorable men, would have sought false witnesses against him. I can imagine they would have scoured the land to find witnesses that would have been adverse to him. But I can't really justify, I can't imagine these men, the leaders of the people, who would actually intentionally set out to find false witnesses. And yet that's what Matthew says that happened. And Mark mentions that many bore false witness to him, but that their witness didn't agree together. One would say one thing that was false, and another would say something else that was false. And like falsehoods usually, they didn't agree together. And yet there came two people that said, "We'll testify against him." And these two people brought some witness or brought some evidence before the council, which, if it could be proved that he said this, he would be guilty of death on two counts, that of sorcery and that of sacrilege. And it was this thing that he mentioned back earlier in his ministry. One person stood up and said, "I heard him say, 'I am able to destroy this temple and raise it in 3 days.'" The second witness, who was supposed to have corroborated that evidence, said, "I heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple and raise it in 3 days.'" Well, that threw the place in confusion. Well, why? Well, you say, that's such a small difference. One says, "I'm able to do it," and the other said, "I will do it." You mean that was the difference between the two witnesses? That's right. Matthew records one of them. Mark records the other. And Mark says on two occasions, right in this very context, he said that the witnesses didn't agree among themselves. Now, you may think that that's a strange and a very small difference between two testimonies. And yet the Jewish people were so law-oriented, they were so nitpicking in their application of laws, looking for loopholes, and they were so expertise in applying the law and in twisting it and bending it, that this stood out as evidence. Well, here their evidence was about to go down the drain. And so it seems that everything they tried, nothing worked. Everything failed. Their false witnesses didn't agree together. Then when they got two people that were going to testify about the same thing, that didn't even agree. And then it seemed as though Caiaphas took charge and said, "Right, something's got to be done." And so he just turned to Jesus and said, "I adjure you by the living God, are you the Christ?" And what he did, he applied the famous oath of the testimony, which the Mishnah says that a person once confronted with this challenge, he has to answer it. And so, though it was illegal, Jesus was given this challenge. He was presented with this charge: "You either tell us or else," is what it amounted to. Of course, the whole trial was illegal. Jesus wasn't even supposed to be tried at night. Any man being tried for a capital offense was not to be tried at night. He couldn't be tried after sundown. It had to be tried during the day. And also, once the testimony of the witnesses had broken down, it was against the law for anyone to turn then to the prisoner and cross-examine him. But all of this was being done. You see, they didn't care about whether it was legal or not, it seemed. And so finally, Caiaphas turned to Jesus and said, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us whether or not you're the Christ." And so Jesus then said, "I am. And furthermore, you're going to see the Son of Man seated by the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And it was just adding insult to injury. The old high priest became so enraged. He did that classical demonstration of agony as he took his garment and just ripped it, and said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? We've heard with our own ears from his own lips. What do we need with witnesses?" And then he turned to the assembly and he said, "What is your verdict?" And the men said, "He's worthy of death." And then they got together in a caucus, a political religious caucus. Mark mentions it, describes it in the 15th chapter, and says that the chief priests and the rulers and the scribes, these men all got together in a huddle, and then they delivered him up to be tried before Pilate. They took him to Pilate's place about 5 p.m. in the morning. Now, I want to give you just a very brief idea about how far Jesus traveled in this process before he was crucified. As he left the Mount of Olives and went to the court or went to the house of Caiaphas, that would be probably about a mile and a half. I don't think it's more than that. Maybe it's not more than a mile. We'll say a mile and a half. When they got to Caiaphas or to Annas's place, and they tried him there, then they sent him back over here to the temple area where the Sanhedrin probably met and were under the auspices there of Caiaphas the high priest. So there was another mile from Caiaphas or Annas' place over here to the temple precinct. Then when they got through with trying him there before the Sanhedrin, they took him right on around here into Newtown over to the place of Pilate, Pilate's palace. And when Pilate then heard that he was from Galilee, Pilate sent him back over here just about where I'm standing, but back behind me, to the palace of Herod, which would be another mile and a half. And then when Herod got through with him, after beating him and dressing him up in garments and purple, he sent him back to Pilate for further judgment and finally for the sentence. And then they took him and went around the city, up around Newtown, and came back out to a place just back, say, behind this door to where the traditional site of the crucifixion is. So he went a mile and a half here, another mile there, and then around another couple of miles, and then another mile here, and a mile back, and then a couple of miles around. He must have walked 8 or 10 miles that night. That in itself was enough to make him tired. And all the while, he was being abused and spit upon and slapped and mocked. But anyway, he came before Pilate. Pilate's permanent living quarters were not in Jerusalem. They were in Capernaum, or rather in Caesarea on the seacoast. Caesarea was about 40 miles from Jerusalem. But that's where he lived. He was the one that was really in charge of the Roman forces in the land. And he lived down there and had his other men who were under him living in Jerusalem. But during the Passover feast, because of the volatile situation, it was like a powder keg. It was a real political powder keg every Passover feast. It was springtime. That was the time when people, back in the days of the Jewish people, when the kings went forth to war, it was always in spring. And there's just something about spring that always caused a lot of trouble. And the Passover coming during the springtime and during the messianic expectations of the people, when all of this was high and their hopes were high for some deliverer, there was always a volatile situation during the Passover time. And so Pilate, it seems, for the sake of precaution, stationed himself in the city of Jerusalem during the Passover feast. And that's where he was, over here in his palace at that time. He was in Jerusalem for the purpose of precaution. Now, it's obvious as we began to gather all this material together about Jesus and his pre-trial and all of these various stations to which he was taken, it's obvious that the Jewish leaders were not leaving anything to chance. They were making sure of what they were doing. Now, let me give you some reasons why I say that. Number one, they had already arranged with Judas as to where Jesus could be arrested. Number two, they had given him a band of soldiers who were going to do the dirty work. Number three, the Sanhedrin probably had stayed up all night. They were at least up about 4 o'clock in the morning. I doubt that they went to sleep. I think it was a three-ring circus all night long, interviewing people about trying to find witnesses, trying to set up false testimony. And they would interview this one and then interview that one. And you'd have people saying, "I'll testify," and they'd see if it would hold water. I think it was just an all-night affair. And about 4 o'clock at least, you have all the entire Sanhedrin gathered together there under the auspices of the high priest. And there were 70 or 72 of those men who were up at 4 o'clock in the morning. But not only that, you have all this list of false testimony and these false witnesses that had been arranged for during the night. Plus, you had this legal trap that had been laid by Caiaphas, the oath of the testimony. Now, look, you don't go through all of that without then finding and securing the final capping off of the issue. Finding a place to arrest him, providing him with soldiers, Judas with soldiers, getting the Sanhedrin all up at 4 o'clock in the morning, or they were all together at that hour, and then providing and securing all these false witnesses, and then providing this legal trap for the oath of the testimony. Now, there was only one thing that they had not arranged if they hadn't arranged it, and I believe they did. I believe that the arrangement with Pilate, which was a guarantee by the Roman government that if they delivered this man to the Roman government, that they could be guaranteed of a death sentence. I believe that we can rest assured that this guarantee was given by Pilate to Caiaphas the night before Jesus Christ was arrested and tried. Now, one reason why perhaps this can be assured. A very interesting note in the book of Matthew, in chapter 27 and verse 19. There's someone makes an appearance there in the gospel records, and she's never heard of again. She was never heard of in the gospel records before that. It says, while Pilate was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him. And here's what the note said. Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I've suffered much over him today in a dream. We find that Pilate's wife had a dream about Jesus. Now, Pilate's wife isn't named in the scriptures, but Josephus names her and Roman history names her. Her name was Claudia. Claudia and Pilate. And we know several things that happened. We know two or three events, and then we have to surmise two or three events. We know, for example, that Claudia was in Jerusalem with Pilate during the Passover. We know that. Matthew 27:19 says that. Secondly, we know that Judas had left the upper room after the Passover supper. Judas had left the upper room and had gone to the chief priests and had gotten his payment and had given them a guarantee that he would deliver Jesus into their hands. We know that. We also know that it was cold. We know the temperature. Now, all of this can be gleaned from the scriptures, from the gospel records. Now, after Judas had made his agreement with Caiaphas, after Judas had left the supper and gone to Caiaphas's palace over here and had said, I'll deliver him to you if you'll give me these 30 pieces of silver. Then, when Caiaphas had secured this guarantee from Judas that he would point him out, and Judas says, I'll do it by kissing him. You can tell who it is. I'll kiss him. Caiaphas, if anything follows at all logically, Caiaphas would have gone then to Pilate and said to Pilate, now we need you to give us a guarantee. We're going to have this man brought before you tomorrow. We need you to guarantee that you'll give him the death sentence. Now, how it happened, perhaps we don't know, but let's surmise just a moment. After this final arrangement with Judas, Caiaphas went to Pilate's palace. He's over here now where Pilate was living. Caiaphas left his place and went over here, and he knocked on the door. A soldier who was on guard, because Pilate was a military man, a soldier being there stationed would come to the door and say, yes, what do you want? And Caiaphas would say, I want an audience with Pilate. The soldier then, according to the custom or protocol, would go to Pilate and say, sir, there's a man here, the Jewish high priest, Caiaphas by name, and he wants to speak to you. Pilate and Claudia, since it was cold, perhaps were sitting in front of the fire, just talking or whatever. And Pilate then gets up and comes and takes the high priest into the study, perhaps. And he says, yes, what is it you want? And Caiaphas then tells him this story. We are bringing this man. He's a troublemaker. He's disturbing the people. They're in an uproar. He's a threat to the Roman security here. We're going to bring this troublemaker before you in the morning, and we'll bring sufficient evidence that you'll have cause to sentence him to death. Pilate perhaps says, well, I'll think about it. Or he may have given him the assurance. I don't know. But he went back perhaps then and said to his wife and sat down by the fire, how long do you think it would have been before Claudia would have said, what was that about? Oh, about 5 seconds. And then Pilate could very well have said, well, it was the high priest, Caiaphas. And he wants me to give a death sentence tomorrow on this man, Jesus from Nazareth. And you may very well have heard Claudia say, but this man is a righteous man. I know, I've heard too much about him. Don't do it, Pilate. They're laying a trap for you and him. Don't get into it. But with that on her mind, she goes on to bed. Now, that's surmising that right in there. We just have to kind of surmise that. But now we do know this further. We know that in the morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, when she woke up and looked over in the bed and Pilate wasn't there and she knew where he had gone, she sent him a message. She scribbled out a note and said, "Have nothing to do with this righteous man, for I have suffered much over him today in a dream." And she gave it to a servant and she said, "Take this to Pilate quickly." But it was too late. The trap had already been laid. And it was laid as much for Pilate as it had been laid for Jesus. Both of them could not survive. And since both of them could not survive, and Pilate had the authority to either put Jesus to death or release him, you can suspect who it was that was going to die. The death verdict was certain. Pilate, though, it seems, tried to release Jesus. Matthew records it in detail. John records it in detail. And yet he wasn't successful. Pilate knew that it was for envy that they had delivered him up, Matthew says, and so does Mark. And then Matthew records that this note from Claudia troubled Pilate. And he tried then to release him again, and they wouldn't hear of it. And then the Jews pulled out their trump card and played it. You see, Jesus had claimed to be the Messiah. He had answered in response to this oath of the testimony. When they said, "We adjure you by the name of the living God, are you the Christ?" When Jesus said, "I am," then that sealed his destiny right there. Because that claim to be the Christ was sufficient to guarantee that from the Jewish court he would be branded as a blasphemer. And it was also sufficient that from a Roman court he would be branded as an insurrectionist. He would be branded there for treason. For no one claimed to be a king other than Caesar. And so Jesus was in a trap. Pilate tried to release him. But then Pilate got in the trap. And after they said, "This man claims to be the king of the Jews." And he went back to him and said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he said, "I am." And then there was this conversation between these two men. And he went back and he says, "I still don't find anything wrong with him." And then the Jews literally bore down and put Pilate's neck in the noose. They said, "If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend." And he knew the skullduggery that those Jewish people were equipped to be a part of. He knew they wouldn't stop short of having him killed. And so finally he just simply said, "Well, all right." And John, the 18th chapter and verse 16, and the 19th chapter and verse 16, says, "Then he handed him over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and he went out, bearing his own cross, to the place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote a title and put it on the cross. It read, 'Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews.'" Many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Latin and in Greek. The chief priests of the Jews then said to Pilate, "Don't write 'the King of the Jews,' but 'This man said, I am the King of the Jews.'" Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and made four parts, one for each soldier, also his tunic. But the tunic was without seam, woven from top to bottom. So they said to one another, "Let us not tear it, but let's cast lots for it to see whose it shall be." This was to fulfill the scripture, "They parted my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." So the soldiers did this. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing near, he said to his mother, "Woman, Behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, Behold your mother. And from that hour the disciple took her into his own home. After this, Jesus, knowing all was now finished, said to fulfill the scripture, I thirst. A bowl full of vinegar stood there, so they put a sponge full of the vinegar on hyssop and held it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the vinegar, he said, It is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And that's the record of the death of Jesus the Jew as it's contained in the Gospels. A shorter record of this is contained in the writings of the Romans, in the annals of the Roman government. We're here tonight because this man died. Time, like an ever-flowing stream, bears all its sons away. Not this man. Thank God, not this man. And we're here tonight to give him honor and praise. If you'd like to be a follower of his tonight, the opportunity is yours. And if you'd like to respond, I think you know what to do. Come confess your faith in him. Die to sin as he died to the world. Let yourself be buried as he was buried in a tomb. You be buried in a tomb of water. It's so simple, but that's what he wants. And then he says you'll be raised to walk this new life if you believe. Would you come? Let's stand and sing.